Our first caller today is Bruce from Beaverton, Oregon. Bruce, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. This is a question that I'm sure you've had to deal with before. And
could we have his volume brought up? I can't hear Bruce very well. Go ahead, Bruce.
Can you hear me better?
Yes, thank you.
Okay. The question about the dating of Revelation, and, you know, I know you've dealt with this, but I wonder if we could drill down on it a little bit here. We've got a lot of information about John's life. We know a lot about John. We know, you know, from chapter 1 of Revelation, he is on Patmos. We know the Romans were good, you know, they kept pretty good records and so forth. And I'm just amazed that, you know, it's this big span that, you know, it's either 90s or it's the 60s. You know, a whole 30-year swing there. And can you help us on this? I'd like to start with the external evidence, and then if you think the internal makes a big difference. But I'd like to start what we know externally about, because, you know, it's so important. Is it Nero's age, or is it way back, you know, in the 90s?
Well, when you mentioned that the Romans kept good records, of course they wouldn't take any records of anything related to the book of Revelation, since, first of all, John would have been... John's exile probably would not be kept on record. He was not that famous in the Roman world. He became famous when Christianity became more dominant. In the first century, in the life of the apostles, they were pretty small players in terms of Roman history. After Rome became Christian, of course, in the time of Constantine, then all the apostles were, you know, heroes in retrospect. But there's not any reason why we would expect the Roman historians to make any mention of John being exiled to Patmos, especially if that was a very common thing to do to prisoners. So I don't think we have complete prisoner lists from the Romans. In fact, we don't have very many documents of any kind from the Romans of that period that have survived. The Romans had several historians, and a few of them, their parts of their works have survived, not all their works. But I wouldn't be surprised at all if the Romans never mentioned John in any of their writings. And if they did, it's possible that those writings could have been lost. So we don't have any information from the secular Romans about when John was on Patmos. The external evidence for an early date would be based on a few things, like the fact that the Muratorian Canon, which was written, I think, in the second century, mentions that Paul, in writing to seven churches, was following the lead of John, who had written to seven churches. Now, John, of course, only wrote to seven churches in the book of Revelation, as far as we know. And to say that Paul, writing to seven churches, as it says in the Muratorian Canon in the second century, was following the lead of his progenitor, or the one before him, John, who had written to seven churches, it sounds like it's saying that John wrote to seven churches before Paul did. Now, Paul died in 67, probably, A.D., and if John had already written to seven churches, that is, if he'd already written the book of Revelation, that would mean it would have been completed before 70 A.D. There's also certain phrases in Revelation that are referred to in other books of the Bible. One of them that I find very interesting is in Revelation 2:10, where Jesus says to the church of Smyrna, "Be faithful unto death, and I'll give you the crown of life." Interestingly, James, who died in the middle of the sixth decade of the first century and wrote the book of James, he seems to allude back to this promise in Revelation 2:10, where James says that that God has promised the crown of life to those who are faithful and who love him. Now, there's only one promise of Jesus that people will receive the crown of life that we have on record. It's not in the Gospels. It's in Revelation 2:10. And when James says that Christ has promised the crown of life to those who endure to the end, who love him, in my opinion, he sounds like he's referring to the promise made to the church of Smyrna in chapter 2 and verse 10. Now, James could only be referring to that if Revelation existed for him to read and to know about that. And James died in the 60s, which would mean that Revelation would have been written prior to the death of James and therefore in the 60s. These are external evidences. There are some others, but not a great number. The external evidence for the later date in the reign of Domitian, which would be in the 90s, comes primarily from Irenaeus. Irenaeus was about the same time as the Muratorian canon, but he seemed to indicate that John was exiled to Patmos during the time of Domitian. Now, there is some question as to the meaning of Irenaeus' passage, and there are some scholars who believe that what Irenaeus was saying is not that the book of Revelation was written in the time of Domitian, but that John lived until and was last seen during the time of Domitian. It's a somewhat ambiguous statement of Irenaeus, but it's historically been taken to mean that John was banished to Patmos in the time of Domitian, and that would be in the 90s. And later church fathers, very possibly influenced by Irenaeus, repeated that John was banished in the time of Domitian. So we have quite a few church fathers after the time of Irenaeus who say the same thing Irenaeus said, or at least what Irenaeus seemed to have said. And so we have got church fathers saying that John was writing the book of Revelation during the reign of Domitian, which would be in the 90s. And, of course, we have the Muratorian canon and possibly New Testament books giving the indication that it was written in the earlier part of the first century before 70 AD. Those are the external evidences. There are also some others, a little later ones. For example, in the 8th century, there was a commentary by Aretas on Revelation, who said that the fall of Jerusalem to the Romans had not yet occurred when John wrote the book of Revelation.
Wow.
And Andreas of Cappadocia also seemed to take that position. I mean, there are different voices among the church fathers saying different things. I think the internal evidence is the most important. There's no internal evidence, in my opinion, that is very strong for a Domitianic date, the later date. I realize that those who write commentaries defending the late date, they quote from things in Revelation and say that points in that direction. In my looking at their arguments, I don't think those verses do. On the other hand, there are things in Revelation that point, for example, to the temple still standing in the time that Revelation was written. And, of course, the temple was destroyed in 70 AD, long before Domitian's time. And in Revelation 11, 1 and 2, the temple seems to be standing, but it's going to be given over to the Gentiles to trample it. But it's being measured for the preservation of the faithful remnant in it. That would be relevant to before 70 AD. Also, the fact that Revelation 17:10 tells us that the ruling king at the time of the writing of the book of Revelation was the sixth king. It says, five have fallen, one now is. John is telling his readers that in a series of seven kings, the sixth one was reigning at the moment, and another would come after him, but five had gone before. Many commentators believe that these kings refer to Roman emperors, and the five Roman emperors that fell before Nero would be the ones who are fallen, and Nero was the sixth, and he died in 68 AD. So if Revelation was written during the time of Nero, as it almost sounds like it's saying it was, then it would be written before 70 AD. So there's internal evidence about the time that Revelation was written, and there's external evidence, but I think the internal evidence is stronger and more important because, of course, the internal evidence belongs to the book itself. It's part of the inspired record. External evidence is just what people said about the book, church fathers and so forth. They themselves are not inspired. Even if Irenaeus did say that John wrote during the reign of Domitian, well, if the book itself suggests it was written during the reign of Nero, then we'd have to go with the inspiration of the book and its authors telling us when it was written, rather than an uninspired church father giving us an opinion that might not be correct.
Yeah. You know, can you hear me?
Yes.
I think you make the point in your notes also that the Olivet Discourse is found in all three synoptics, but not in John, and that might reflect that John had already written this prophetic vision.
Yes. Well, the Synoptic Gospels do record Jesus giving what we call the Olivet Discourse, which covers the same ground in many respects as the book of Revelation.
Mm-hmm.
Most scholars, regardless of their viewpoint on eschatology, would agree that the Olivet Discourse is talking about the same subject matter as the book of Revelation. Now, the Olivet Discourse, Jesus said very plainly in all three of the Synoptic Gospels, these things, this generation will not pass before these things take place. Well, 40 years after he said it, Jerusalem was destroyed. And the Olivet Discourse actually predicted the destruction of Jerusalem. In fact, it began with him predicting the destruction of Jerusalem, not one stone to be left standing on another. The disciples asked, when will this be? And he answered with the Olivet Discourse, which, of course, would be applicable to the fall of Jerusalem. So if Revelation is written on the same subject, then it would also be about the fall of Jerusalem in 70 AD. Now, John's Gospel doesn't contain the Olivet Discourse, but it is possible, as you mentioned, that this was because John had already written the book of Revelation before he wrote the Gospel of John, and it would have been superfluous to include the Olivet Discourse after writing such a longer piece on the same subject in the book of Revelation. Anyway, those are some thoughts. As you know, in my book on Revelation 4 Views, I go through the arguments for and against the early date and the arguments for and against the later date.
Thanks, Kate. That's real helpful. I appreciate it.
All right, Bruce. Good talking to you. Let's talk next to Jason from Alabama. Jason, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
How are you doing today, Steve?
Good, thanks.
Good. My question for you today is regarding John chapter 9. In the first verse, it reads, "And Jesus passed by, and he saw a man which was blind from birth. And his disciples asked him, saying, Master, who did sin, this man or his parents, that he was born blind?" And you remember a couple weeks ago, we got on the phone with a friend of mine, and she was talking about that this verse, the question that the disciples asked, proves their theology on a preexistence, because he said that would indicate that by the question that he could have sinned before he was born.
Yes. I mean, I don't agree with that conclusion, but is that something you want me to comment on?
Yes. I just wanted to hear your thoughts on that specific verse and your belief on that specific issue.
Right. The disciples asked Jesus if this man who was born blind was in that condition because of his own sin or his parents. Now, one might argue it was his parents' sin, since he couldn't sin before he was born. On the other hand, if they suggest maybe his sin caused him to be born blind, that would maybe sound like they believed in reincarnation or in the preexistence of the soul or something like that, where a person could sin before they're born. Well, first of all, let me make this point. We're not entirely clear on what the disciples were thinking when they said, did this man sin that he's born that way? It's not impossible that they were thinking that he was born in this condition preemptively because God knew, he foreknew a sin that the man would be committing in his lifetime, and punishing him for that in advance caused him to be born blind. Now, the Bible doesn't teach that. This could be what the disciples were thinking. One thing we know is they weren't thinking correctly. They didn't believe in reincarnation because the Jews, and they were Jews, didn't have reincarnation in their theology. Some rabbis, I am told, believed in such a thing as prenatal sin. That is, sin a fetus in the womb might commit. And they might have been thinking in those terms, that maybe while he was in the womb, he became guilty of some sin and therefore was born blind. One thing we can say for sure is that they were wrong, because Jesus answered them and said neither this man nor his parents sinned. He was born this way so the works of God could be seen in him. So whatever the disciples might have been thinking, Jesus indicated they were not thinking correctly. So if someone says, well, they believed in reincarnation, well, they didn't, but even if they did, Jesus corrects them. They were wrong. By the way, Jesus makes it very clear that reincarnation has nothing to do with this, because if a man was born blind because of bad karma in a previous lifetime, then Jesus would have to admit this man was born this way because of his own sin. Because if this was a matter of karma and reincarnation, as you know, well, then the man did sin, and that's why he was born that way. Karma takes its vengeance on sin, you know, in the next life. So Jesus did not, if the disciples did, Jesus certainly did not believe in reincarnation. Now, I don't think the disciples did either. I think they were thinking either in terms of prenatal sin in the womb, or they were thinking in terms of maybe preemptive judgment on a sin that the man would later commit in life that God foreknew. I don't know what they were thinking. They were certainly thinking wrong, though. And Jesus made it very clear that whatever their thought processes were, they weren't in touch with reality. So we can't say that this question of the disciples somehow proves a preexistence of the soul or something.
I was curious to see what you think about this. When he says, when Mormons say they believe in a preexistence, they take that isolated verse and try to use it as justification. But when from what I'm familiar with evangelical Christianity, anything that we really believe has been taught pretty plainly, or it's been taught multiple times to where we can get a plethora of evidence for this being a true doctrine. And so that was my response in saying, well, you know, what we believe can be demonstrated because it's been taught multiple times, and sometimes even Jesus would double down on some of the things that he said because the people
right.
cannot.
In other words, if in the mouth of two or more witnesses, every word should be established, the Bible says. And if there was, in fact, a biblical truth in the preexistence of a human soul before birth, before conception, I should say, then we couldn't establish it from just one verse. We'd have to have something more than that. However, you know, the preexistence of the soul, the Mormons were not the first ones to come up with it. It's not a biblical doctrine. But Origen, one of the most influential theologians of the past in the 3rd century, believed in the preexistence of the soul, of the human soul. I believe he's wrong, but it was a very early Christian doctrine. The Mormons somehow revived it through Joseph Smith. But I believe it's not a correct doctrine. Certainly none of the scriptures can be said to teach it. I appreciate your call. Let's talk to Jim from Florida. Jim, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi there, Steve. It's actually Tim from Florida, but that's okay.
Oh, sorry. Hi, Tim.
Hey there. My question is, I have a 5-year-old and a 4-year-old, and my question is regarding the Lord's Supper. When I was growing up in Baptist church, you know, oftentimes they're passing the communion elements across, and you want to, as a little kid, you'd love to have a little snack. And so, of course, your parents are always saying, well, you know, you have to accept Jesus into your heart before you do this, and you know, usually be baptized as well. And, of course, you know, older siblings are doing that. So, ultimately, that kind of became, in my opinion, one of the baits in my mind as to why I want to become a Christian. And that's not a good reason, but nonetheless, that's what children think. So I have a 5-year-old and a 4-year-old, and they're starting to ask questions about communion and the Lord's Supper at church. And so my question is, how do you feel about children taking communion? I mean, I recognize the traditional answers of being a follower of Christ, of course. However, you look at Judas, for example, in the Lord's Supper story in the Bible, Jesus knew that he had already betrayed him, and he seemed to be okay with him taking it. And you also have statements of Jesus, such as, let the little ones come unto me, and so on. So my question is how do you feel about children taking communion?
Well, I do not see myself as capable of disagreeing with the policies of the early church in the absence of Scripture. To the contrary, from the earliest days of the church, the assumption was that a person is not a Christian if they're not baptized. They weren't at least part. They weren't at least in the church if they weren't baptized. Now, this was, of course, referring to adult believers. In the 2nd and 3rd generation, of course, there would be children who were born in the church fellowship. But it was still understood that until you're baptized, you haven't really become a Christian. And that communion was only for Christians. So the early church fathers all assumed that communion would only be administered to baptized believers. And the early records of the church.
Well, had Jesus' disciples been baptized at the point of the Last Supper?
Well, if they ever were, they were by then. You know, I mean, we don't know when the disciples were baptized, if they were baptized by Jesus. They were no doubt baptized by John the Baptist before they knew Jesus. Jesus may have rebaptized them. If he didn't during their lifetimes, we certainly have no record of them being baptized afterwards. I'm sure they were baptized because, you know, baptism was something all righteous people were being called to. Remember when John said, "Why should I baptize you? You should baptize me." Jesus said, "Let it be so that we could fulfill all righteousness," meaning being baptized was part of what was required to fulfill all righteousness. And so it seems inconceivable that Jesus would have allowed his disciples to neglect that when he himself couldn't even neglect it, although he didn't need it like others. In my opinion, and a person is welcome to search the scriptures and reach a different opinion if they want to, but in my opinion, I think baptism precedes the Lord's Supper in a person's life.
Okay.
Now, like you said, a child might say, "Well, I feel left out because I don't get to drink this little grape juice and eat this little cracker, so I'll just become a Christian." I think one has to guard against that. I really don't think the little thimble of grape juice and the little cracker is an extremely strong bait toward conversion. I think that it's not that satisfying a meal. Now, in biblical times, post-biblical times, communion was a whole meal. It was the agape feast. And I'm sure the children participated in the agape feast, but I believe there was a part of it in which the feast was interrupted, where they'd take bread and wine ceremonially. And I think that the unbaptized children probably did not participate. But we don't have thorough records of all this.
Now, do you think children ate the Passover meal? I mean, in a Jewish culture, because that's what they were
did.
All kind of still.
Yes, they did. Uh-huh. And okay. And one could use that as an argument for them taking the love feast also. All I know is that the early church had a strong opinion that people had to be baptized first. Now, that's tradition.
Okay.
The Bible doesn't say that, so a person could disagree and do something differently. But where there's kind of a unanimous view of the church from earliest times, I feel comfortable disagreeing if it's an unbiblical practice. But I don't know that it's an unbiblical practice. I don't have any good biblical reasons to disagree with them.
Okay. You know, I coincidentally go to a church that's Reformed Presbyterian. Now, I've personally fallen away from a lot of their views through some of your influence. I don't consider myself a Calvinist, but I still go there, and they actually baptize infants. Now, we've never had our children baptized because I don't agree with it. But nonetheless, that's where we're at. So if I had my children baptized as infants, if I had a clear conscience that I'm using this Lord's Supper to lead them, you know, towards Christ, would you see anything wrong with that?
Not necessarily. I mean, I don't think there's any magic in the Lord's Supper. I think the Lord's Supper is a memorial, but I think in order to meaningfully participate in a memorial, you must be remembering something that you have some participation in. So, you know, I think a person needs to be reborn before the memorial of Christ's death and for them can be very meaningful. But I think that if someone happens to drink the juice or the wine and eat the cracker who is not converted, I don't think that this is I don't think this is a grave sin. Some people would say so because of Paul's statement in 1 Corinthians 11. But I think they misunderstand him when he says whoever eats and drinks in an unworthy manner eats and drinks condemnation. He's not talking about a child or even an unbeliever. He's talking about believers who are getting drunk and depriving each other of food at the love feast. He says so. You know, so I mean, that's a very different matter.
Okay. Well, thank you. I appreciate your answer.
I appreciate your call. Thanks for joining us today. We're going to take a break for just about 30 seconds, and when we come back, we'll take more calls. We have another half hour to go. The program is half over. Some stations leave us at this point, and so we want those listeners to those stations to know that you can hear the whole program at our website, thenarrowpath.com. It streams from there. We also archive the programs there so you can listen to them later. You can also get the mobile app, thenarrowpath.com, for your iPhone or for your Android device. And you can hear the whole show every day from there. The Narrow Path is listener supported. You can write to us at The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. You can also donate if you wish from our website, though everything there is free. It's thenarrowpath.com. If you can hang with us for 30 seconds, we'll be right back to take more calls.
The book of Hebrews tells us, do not forget to do good and to share with others. So let's all do good and share The Narrow Path with Steve Gregg with family and friends. When the show is over today, tell one and all to go to thenarrowpath.com where they can study, learn, and enjoy with free topical audio teachings, blog articles, verse-by-verse teachings, and archives of all The Narrow Path radio shows. And be sure to tell them to tune into the show right here on the radio. Share listener-supported The Narrow Path with Steve Gregg. Share and do good.
Welcome back to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we are continuing to take phone calls for another half hour. Right now our lines are full, but if you want to call in this half hour, you may be able to get in if you take this number down and call in a few minutes when a line opens up. The number is 844-484-5737. That's 844-484-5737. And our next caller today is going to be Jeffrey from San Francisco. Hi, Jeff. Welcome to the Narrow Path.
Hey, man. Hey, Steve. How are you?
Good.
Just want to make a quick comment. Before Donald Trump, I would plainly say Donald Trump is not a Christian because he's too brash. He doesn't understand the importance of humility, you know? So that's that. I mean, he's so much media person.
Let me just comment on that, if I could. I would certainly not argue that Donald Trump is a Christian because I have no knowledge of the man firsthand. And I would say that many things he has done and continues to do would be things I would advise Christians not to do. On the other hand, if he were, in fact, a Christian, he would not be the first Christian I've ever known of who lacks humility.
Right. Absolutely, yeah.
So you have a question.
Yeah, well, I just want to make a quick question. Are you still having your Bible studies Thursdays in Temecula?
Yes.
Okay. I plan to be in Southern California this summer, and I'd like to attend one of those and possibly if we can have a private conversation. My question is, Steve, I've been listening to your lectures on spiritual warfare.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was the one that you did after you left Sacramento back in March.
Okay, and, Seattle, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was very informing, informative. Correct me if I'm wrong, did you say early on in your Christianity that you performed an exorcism?
I have, on a few occasions, yes, performed exorcisms.
Oh, wow. I thought that was just for the Catholic priest to perform.
Well, there were no Catholic priests in the Bible, and I follow the Bible, not the Catholic Church, so... it was the casting of demons was done by Jesus and by his disciples. In fact, he said in Mark chapter 16, these signs shall follow those who believe. In my name they shall cast out demons. And we see, of course, the apostles doing that. And even I think Stephen and Philip did that, too. So and they weren't apostles. So, yeah, there's nothing in the Bible that suggests that only the Bible knows nothing about Catholic priests. There were no Catholic priests for several centuries and after the Bible was written, but there's nothing in the Bible to limit it.
Oh, okay. Yeah, so if somebody were to ask you, Steve, I think I might have a demon in my life, can you remove it? Would you perform a whatever?
Well, that would depend. I'd want to talk to them and find out why they think those things. And if I felt that was true, I would certainly be open to that.
Okay. So I'm going to ask you, I mean, what does God want us to know concerning spiritual warfare? What should we know?
You know, I think what God wants us to know is that we are involved in a warfare. And the warfare is the kingdom of God versus the kingdom of darkness. And as disciples of Christ, of course, we are here to hold our own ground and take ground from the enemy by the preaching of the gospel. That's what we're here to do. And we should understand that this is going to be not easy, because war is not easy. Paul said to Timothy, endure hardship as a good soldier of Jesus Christ. And a lot of Christians, I think, don't know that they're being recruited into a battle when they become a Christian. They think they're just getting a free ticket to heaven, which, of course, we do get a ticket to heaven, so to speak. But I think people need to be informed that there's going to be a great deal of hostile opposition that they have to stand against and overcome, and that God has a mission that he calls us to be a part of. So I'd say those are the things, those are the essential things that a person has to know about spiritual warfare, I think. But there are more things to know than that. I think God would like us to know everything he has to say about the subject, but you can survive without knowing everything. There's lots of things in the Bible that are taught that every Christian should know, and a person who really devotes himself to the study of the Bible will know. But lots of Christians don't know them because they don't study their Bibles that well, and I think they can still be saved, but I think they are diminished in terms of their capacity to live a normal Christian life on if they don't know the things that, you know, that God has said about these things. All right, I need to move along then. I appreciate your call. Let's talk next to Norma from Sacramento, California. Norma, welcome to The Narrow Path.
Hi, Steve. I just have a couple of questions here. I have been listening to you use the word dispensationalist. It's hard for me to pronounce.
That's easy for you to say.
I don't know what you mean by that. I do know that when you refer to one who is that, they believe in the rapture, they believe in the tribulation coming on the earth, and I just have a question, is what is your meaning behind that word, dispensationalist?
Dispensationalist. Dispensationalism.
Uh-huh. Yes.
It's a theological construct that was invented by a man named John Nelson Darby in the 1830s. His theology took a significant departure from the theology of the whole church previously, and he himself said so. He admitted that he was taken a different way. He said none of the older commentaries taught what he taught. He said it was a newly revealed truth to him. And that truth was that whereas the church had always believed from the New Testament teaching that the church is the people of God, the new Israel, that he had revealed to him, he was an Anglican priest, and he had it revealed to him that there's two peoples of God. There's the church and there's natural Israel. And he believed that many promises that God made to Israel in the Old Testament still need to be fulfilled to natural Israel, ethnic Israel. The church had never believed that previously. And so he began to teach that there are dispensational truths. There's a dispensation that applies to the church. There's other dispensations that apply to Israel. He took the verse rightly dividing the word of truth from Paul and 1 Timothy. And he said some truths are for the church, some are for Israel, and some are for the world. And so he began to see not two categories of human beings, saved and unsaved, the church and the lost, but there's a third category of people who, although not currently saved, were still God's chosen people and would be saved later on without becoming part of the church. That the saved in Israel would have a separate destiny for eternity from the saved in the church. He believed that Israel would be God's eternal earthly people, and the church would be God's heavenly people forever. A friend of mine, when he heard that, says, okay, so the Jews get consigned to the ghetto again, right? I mean, the church gets to go to heaven, and the Jews have to be on earth. In any case, that was a snide remark he made. They believe that the earth will be a perfect earth and that it'll be a wonderful paradise, but they believe that the tribulation saints will be Jews who never become part of the church because they believe the church will be gone before the tribulation. This is all part of Darby's teaching. It was never taught before the 1830s. And, you know, therefore part of his teaching was that the latter 7 years of earth's history prior to the second coming of Christ are for the dispensation of Israel, not of the church. Therefore, the church must be raptured out of the world before that 7 years begins, and that's called the pre-tribulation rapture. And then he said that 7 years will then be the 70th week of Daniel, which is related to Israel's salvation. And so he also believed, and no one, as far as I know, ever before Darby ever taught, that during the millennium, the Jewish temple will be set up again and animal sacrifices will be offered again for 1,000 years in commemoration of the death of Jesus. So they will offer bulls and goats and so forth, and there will be Levitical priests just like in the Old Testament. This is also part of dispensationalism. This is a view that I was raised believing because it happens to be the most popular view in evangelical churches in this part of the world. And because of this part of the world, which influences the rest of the world in much of the world, evangelical churches have simply been born into this dispensational idea. But most of the churches throughout history, and many churches to this day, still do not buy into dispensationalism. For example, the Reformed churches don't. The Churches of Christ don't. The Church of God, Anderson, Indiana, does not. And there's many, there are certain Pentecostal churches that don't, and non-denominational churches that don't. But still, the biggest denominations, groups like the Southern Baptists, the Assemblies of God, Calvary Chapel movement, which is one of the 10 largest denominations in the world, they are all very strongly dispensationalists, and they are very large movements, so that they have disproportionate influence over the thinking of Christians. In fact, essentially, I'm not sure what the right word would be. Most of the media Christian teaching that you'll hear on the radio and Christian television is dispensational. And most of the popular books, certainly almost all Christian novels about the end times are dispensational. And frankly, an awful lot of Bible commentaries that you buy are from dispensational writers because Dallas Theological Seminary was founded by Lewis Sperry Chafer to teach dispensationalism, and they've pumped out a great number of dispensational teachers and pastors and broadcasters and writers, scholars, and so forth over the past 150 years or whatever it's been. And therefore, a great number of commentators and teachers, radio broadcasters, and so forth, are also dispensationalists. So you get a lot of it, and that's what dispensationalism is. If you want a somewhat more in-depth contrast between dispensationalism and the historic view of the church, what was taught before dispensationalism, you may take an interest in some lectures of mine called When Shall These Things Be? If you go to my website, thenarrowpath.com, there's a tab you can click on that says topical lectures, and there's a series called When Shall These Things Be? You can listen to those lectures for free. There's nothing for sale there. And if you do, I do kind of discuss the dispensational view alongside historic Christianity and make the contrast and show scripturally why the dispensationalists think what they do, what scriptures they use, but also what scriptures are used to point out their error. Anyway, that is... That's my summary of dispensationalism. I hope that's helpful. Let's talk to Reggie from Vallejo, California. Reggie, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Thank you, Steve. Thank you. Love your program.
Thank you.
I have two quick questions, and I can hear them over the air. One, in the Exodus, one passage says they were in slavery for 400 years. Another says 430 years.
Mm-hmm.
So I just wanted to understand that. Number two, about Calvinism. Does Calvinism eliminate free will? Is that a misconception? I don't understand Calvinism fully, but those are the two questions there.
Okay.
Calvinism and the time of Exodus.
Okay.
Thank you.
Sure. Thanks for your call. Well, the length of time that Israel is said to have been in bondage in Egypt is sometimes said to be 400 years, sometimes 430 years. There's a couple of ways you can look at this. One of them would be that it really was 130 years literally, but that when it says 400 years, it's just rounding it off. In other words, it's not making an effort to be precise. It's just saying, it's just like, you know, when I was 59, I used to tell people, I'm 60. I wasn't lying about it. I was just thinking in my terms of I'm bordering on 60. I'm in my 60th year. It wasn't quite accurate. And if they wanted to really know, I sometimes would even tell them, I'm really not going to be 60 until such and such a time. But you don't always, unless you're trying to be precise, you don't always have to be precise. You can round things off. So 4 centuries, one could argue. And it might be literally 430 years, but still, when people are not trying to be as precise, and there's many times no reason to have to be exact, some would just say 400 years. Now, another view that I'm aware of is that 430 years would be beginning from the first time Abraham went down into Egypt in chapter 12 of Genesis, and Sarah, and perhaps Isaac in her womb. Isaac wasn't in her womb yet. Probably he was in chapter 20, but not in chapter 12. But Sarah, in any case, and Isaac, unconceived as yet, was in captivity. She became part of Pharaoh's harem. And some would say that's the beginning of Israel's captivity in Egypt, which was not continuous, but it began there, as it were. And then it was 430 years after that that they came out in the Exodus. Now, the 400, they would say, is measured from another point. Perhaps a point in Isaac's life when he was being persecuted by the Egyptian handmaiden's son, Ishmael. And so that he was being afflicted, as it were, by the Egyptian at that time. And that'd be about 30 years later. So, I mean, you'd have to really read books with these different positions, especially this latter position, to see the merits and the arguments for it. But it is possible that the 430 is measuring from a certain date, and the 400 is from a date 30 years later. And as I said, the earlier date might be the first time that Israel, as it were, in Abraham and Sarah went down into Egypt and were in captivity there. And then the affliction of Israel for 400 years, which is mentioned, I think, in the 15th chapter of Genesis, predicted, it begins with Isaac's weaning and the persecution he received from his half-brother, who was half-Egyptian, from the Egyptian mother Hagar. Anyway, those are some of the ways that this has been wrestled with. I think most people, because the second view is rather complicated and requires somewhat more explanation and even more defense before it's, you know, easily grasped, I think some people would just settle with, you know, the 400 is a round number and 430 is the literal number. I'm not going to take a stand, but I think I lean toward the second view. Now, the other question you had was, does Calvinism eliminate free will? Well, it depends on which brand and what you mean by free will. Calvin and Luther did not believe in free will. Luther even wrote a book called The Bondage of the Will, arguing against free will. Many Calvinists, Spurgeon and others, have said that free will is a delusion, and it's because they're Calvinistic. They believe that there's only one will in the universe, that's God's will, and he has foreordained everything that will happen. So when we feel that we're making free choices, or appear to be making free choices, though we don't sense it, God has already foreordained that we'll make those choices and we will inevitably do it. That is a classic Calvinist view of free will, and it was taught by Calvin and many of the Reformers. Modern Calvinists sometimes prefer something they call compatibilism or compatibilistic free will. And they say that, well, God is sovereign and his will is always done, but we have free will too. It's just that having free will doesn't mean you can do just everything. For example, if I argue that I have free will, that doesn't mean that I can just go into Fort Knox and start carrying away gold bars. I'm not even sure there's any there left anymore, but if there was, I can't just walk into the bank and into a safe deposit box that's not mine and take it. I have free will, but there's limits to what I can do. They'd stop me at the door. I can't just fly across the room just because I think that'd be fun. Just because I have free will doesn't mean I can do everything. Some things are against nature. Some things I'm prevented from doing. And they would say that the unbeliever by nature cannot do anything righteous. And therefore, although he has free will, he can only do unrighteous things. He can make all kinds of choices, but they're all going to be unrighteous choices. And therefore, they say the free will is compatible with God's sovereignty, that unless God intervenes to allow a person to make certain decisions, like to repent and believe, that they can't do so. But within the realm of their nature, there is free will. And so some Calvinists will say very plainly they don't believe in free will at all. Others will say, no, we do, but it's a compatibilistic free will. And to them that means it's got to be compatible with God's ordaining everything, but you know, somehow you can still have free will. To my mind, neither view is biblical. Free will is biblical, certainly. It's the teaching of Scripture that God holds people accountable for free choices they make because they make them responsibly. You can't be really responsible for a choice if you didn't have any choice in the matter. I mean, someone can hold you responsible, but they'll be unjust to do so. You can only really be justly held responsible for something that you had some capacity to choose it or not. And so I don't believe that the Bible teaches any form of Calvinism, and either form of Calvinism, whether it teaches that there's no free will or only compatibilistic free will. I think the Bible teaches libertarian free will. But libertarian free will doesn't mean, you know, that you can do anything you want to. It does mean, though, that there's no particular categories of behavior that you couldn't choose. You can choose to follow God, or you can choose not to follow God. You can choose to live unrepentant in sin, or you can choose to repent. That's what I mean by libertarian free will. It doesn't mean that I can choose to be the president of the United States and necessarily become the president of the United States. I might choose it, and it may be withheld from me. Maybe no one will vote for me. But the truth is, we can't control everything in our lives by our free will, but we can certainly make our own choices about what we will do within the range of, you know, human possibility. All right, let's talk to Eric from Seattle. Eric, good to hear from you again. Welcome.
Hi, Steve. I have a question about divorce. I've heard you talk about the topic, and I've read your written article at thenarrowpath.com, but I wonder if you can go into a little more detail on a couple of scenarios about when a spouse is being abusive. I know that in some cases you recommend separation as a first step in order for a person to be safe from physical harm and not just jump into divorce. But like consider a situation where there was a woman who was being abused by her husband. She left her country, came to the U.S. and took steps to get a divorce. Her husband followed, came to the U.S., found where she was living and said, hey, I want to talk to her to get reconciled. But when she came out to talk to him, he pulled out a gun and shot her dead.
In that case, she has grounds for divorce.
I agree. So how do you weigh the risk of harm from an insanely jealous spouse when you're recommending that someone try to, you know, separate and make it really obvious that the, you know, the abusive spouse is the one who's in the wrong because of breaking the marriage vows and the covenant? Or,
well, first of all, I don't recommend separation as a generic policy. I just believe there's times when separation can be justified because of the danger to the wife and children, or maybe to the husband and the children, of staying in the marriage because of violence and, you know, possible lethal harm that can come to them. All I'm saying is I leave that door open, that a woman doesn't have to just stand there in the marriage and get beaten to death. I think she can go to a safe place. I don't say she should file for divorce in that case, but I think she can certainly remove herself and the children to a place of safety. Now, having said that, one has to evaluate what a place of safety is and what it is not. You're giving an example of someone who left perhaps an unsafe home and didn't find safety because her husband hunted her down and killed her. There's always that possibility. There's really nothing that can be done to guarantee that criminals won't commit crimes. We're just talking about whether the woman has a moral liberty to remove herself from a dangerous place. Now, obviously, removing yourself from a dangerous place into a more dangerous situation, in other words, if the husband's going to come and kill you because you did it, then your new situation may be more dangerous than the one you left. That's a matter of wisdom and discretion. That's not a matter of morality there. I'm talking about what may be permitted or may not be permitted within the realm of righteousness. And to leave one's husband should not be done lightly, but it should be open to somebody who finds that their life is truly in danger by staying in the home. But that doesn't mean that I require them to go, or that if they do go, they won't find more danger outside. It's a dangerous world out there. And if this woman's husband had never come and shot her, another total stranger on the street might have robbed her and shot her and raped her. I mean, that happens, unfortunately, to people. We can't really guarantee that won't happen. But if we're asking, did the woman sin by leaving an abusive home, my thought is not necessarily. So that's really all I'm thinking of in terms of this discussion.
Okay. What about a situation? There was another one someone mentioned to me because I've been discussing these things online. Another situation, someone she knew came across a woman who was tied up in her basement and had been beaten for 2 weeks by her husband. When they rescue that woman, is she justified in just divorcing immediately? Or does she need to, does that not meet what you see as the criteria for a legitimate divorce in God's eyes?
Well, I am not God. All I know is that if I were her, I would leave, go to a safe place, and I would not file for divorce. Now, I would say this. If somehow not filing for divorce caused the danger not to be abated and there needed to be a legal divorce or something like that in order to remain safe, then I would say getting a divorce might be okay, but remarriage I would not suggest unless the husband has been cheating. Now, on the other hand, there's another way of looking at this, and I even bring this up in my article, which you've read, and that is that if a husband is so abusive, he's probably not a Christian. He may be a professing Christian, but if a professing Christian is behaving that way, he can be put through the process of church discipline that Jesus gives in Matthew 18. And if he doesn't change, he can be renounced as a heathen. And that's what Jesus said in Matthew 18, verses 15 through 17. And if he's a heathen, then this situation would fall into the category of what Paul said in 1 Corinthians 7, assuming that the woman is a Christian. Her husband is therefore a heathen, and he certainly is not content to dwell with her as a husband if he's tying her up and beating her. That's not what husbands do. That's just what criminals do. That's not a husband. That's a jailer. That's a kidnapper. That's something else. And if he doesn't want to be a husband, which apparently that man didn't, then I would say that she could be under the teaching of 1 Corinthians 7, 12 through 15, that, she could be free from that marriage. I'm sorry we're out of time for today's program. You've been listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg. We are listener-supported. You can write to us at The Narrow Path. You can find the address at our website, thenarrowpath.com.